Welcome to the Green Majority, Canada's longest-running environmental news hour. Canada's least listened to radio show in all of history.
There is no way that is true.
We are on CIUT 89.5 FM, or your local community radio station, or your podcast application, Harbinger Media Network. David Franklin, Erwin Hostetter, Stephen Christian, Erwin Hostetter, Lauren Elizabeth Corlatour. Lauren is in Otitiwa. We are in Toronto.
That took me a second to disentangle. And okay, and I uphold, I don't think we're the nation's least listened to radio show. But I would accept maybe the most unintentionally listened to. Like, because we are syndicated on several radio stations, I'm sure it's like somebody turns on the radio. Who does that anymore? But like on a whim. And then it's like, what am I listening to? These people are terrible. And then listen to it for 10 more minutes and then turn it off. I'd accept that.
I think we deserve more credit than both of you are giving us.
It's called humility, Stefan. Get some.
No.
Canada's hairiest environmental radio show.
Hey, come on. That's like loaded for me.
I also, again, probably this environmental radio show, someone out there must have more hair than us.
That's true, actually.
Those guys that were in the Ripley's Believe It or Not show back in the 90s. It was like a bunch of... They almost definitely have a podcast. Like, there's no way.
Believe it or not, these podcast hosts are carrying 55 kilograms of hair, body hair, between the three of them. You can't tell from hearing their voices, but they are screaming through a tunnel of hair.
David, for the love of God, I am looking for a boyfriend right now. Do not put it out there. And I have a freakish amount of body hair. I have a normal amount for a woman with dark hair and like an unclear ethnic background. Okay.
I'll take 54 pounds of the body hair for myself. So the two of you can split the last pound, which also seems like a lot, to be honest.
Which is still a lot. And like, yeah, I'm an environmentalist. I don't shave my armpits, but like still, it's not that wild.
And Stefan will be speaking with Regeneration.
They're going after business students and trying to take down companies that are not taking climate change seriously, social license to operate.
What does that even mean, though? What does that mean?
Like, a lot of business students go into business so that they can go into these sort of like highfalutin jobs. Either, you know, with rich banks or consultant companies or oil companies, yada. And they are trying to sort of push forward that the jobs that should be considered high status are not these types of jobs, but actually are jobs that are trying to, you know, take climate change seriously and make people's lives better. And so they're trying to like put a wedge into the idea of what a prestigious job is for these young business students that all of these other companies really want to get this top talent.
They want to convince business graduates to make less money. Is that what you're saying?
They're working to convince business students and students more generally that what we consider high status jobs should not be dictated by exclusively the money you can make, but in fact should be have to do with the good you're doing in the world or the ways that you aren't leading to, you know, the death and destruction of all mankind.
I still don't understand what it is that they're doing, but we'll find out in the interview, I guess.
Yes, you listen to the interview.
I don't understand the world of jobs and communication. Okay, so we're going to do some climate news before we get to Stefan's interview. Boeing planes are still falling apart in the air a few years after two of their planes malfunctioned and killed hundreds of passengers. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has now been stranded for a second time this year because he was trying to get on a Boeing plane and it just was not good enough. It had some sort of mechanical failure. And for almost 20 years now, Boeing has been systematically firing people with experience and expertise in order to make planes as cheaply as possible to boost their stock price, allowing shareholders to continue to loot the system. Jim McNerney, the CEO who began the trend at Boeing, was also a member of the Obama administration's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness. Last month, a 30-year employee of Boeing, John Barnett, was in the middle of preparing his testimony against Boeing when he was found shot in the head in his car. Barnett had been struggling against Boeing's management demands of ignoring safety problems and shoddy workmanship before he was fired. And Boeing also makes helicopters, rockets, satellites, and missiles. So they're like a big, they're a big defense contractor, not just commercial planes.
The main reason I wanted to talk about this story is that it's maybe like the most egregious current example, although I'm sure if listeners could correct me on that, I bet you there's some pharmaceutical companies out there or some other people who are cutting corners that are costing millions of lives in other ways. But it's the kind of thing that grabs your attention because planes are falling out of the air. People who are testifying about why that's happened are being murdered. Like, it feels such an obvious example of a corporation that has gone completely off the rails and is a desperate, desperate cry for someone to step in and actually take action to regulate and to tamp down the company. I mean, like, if you can be an airplane company, you know, whose planes keep flying out of the sky or falling out of the sky, then have we just decided that every company now that has a monopoly big enough can just do whatever they want and that we will never see repercussions for anyone who is causing any of these problems? Like, is that the world that we've basically just accepted that we live in now? In the interview that you'll hear later, we talk a little bit about how the need to maximize profits has really begun to erode a lot of value that we used to get in society, like whether it's from media or honestly the internet or movies. Like, a lot of the places where we used to find value have gotten worse and worse and worse as these companies have tried to just maximize profit. And those are annoying on a day-to-day basis, but it's not planes falling out of the sky bad. And so this to me is a bit more of an example of just like how bad we're just allowing things to get before it seems like anyone wants to step in and cause any kind of a stir to the corporate control that we seem to live in. You know, it reminds me a little bit of the fact that we discovered a couple weeks ago that Loblaws through Shoppers was sort of pressuring their pharmacies to bill our Medicare system more and more money than they should have. And we just sort of forgot about that within a couple days. It's like, can they do any, is there anything we can do? Or is there anything that they can do that would make us actually turn around and say no? And it's shocking that you can get this bad. But anyways, to you, Lauren.
Well, and A, that it can get this bad before people will say anything. But then also like the sort of like the legal parameters put around sort of actions in order to do anything to theoretically like better the behaviors or the actions of a given company. Because when as soon as like the term like fiduciary responsibility is brought up, and the idea that like ultimately at the end of the day, from a legal standpoint, I believe more often than not, again, somebody can please correct me if I'm wrong, but like the responsibility of a given company's, say, board of directors, for instance, isn't to provide the best product or the best service they can for the customer. The ultimate priority from a legal standpoint is to provide the highest return on investments for shareholders that they possibly can. And like, until that from a legal standpoint is rescinded or adjusted in some capacity, like, yeah, like this is the fate. This is the bed that we have made. And now we have to lie in it. And we made it back in like what, the 70s and 80s under like Reaganomics, basically. Hearing about the situation at Boeing, you know, I'm calling it now. Give it 2, max 4 years. There will be a prestige TV series about this. The same way, like, yeah, there's like, I think like 2 different series out about like the pharmaceutical industry and the opioid addiction crisis, for instance. Anyway, we're going to get the same thing, but with Boeing, especially with this recent terrible, terrible announcement of this former employee who died under suspicious circumstances. But anyway, there's a really good John Oliver episode that I referenced before we turned on our mics today. And it's like a big 20-minute section all about Boeing. And it goes into like, to a degree, like tracing the ways that, like, aside from like the larger sort of like macroeconomic structures in place, why Boeing specifically has gotten as bad as it has. And they trace it back to this like one merger with a different company back in like the late 90s. And that company was known for cutting corners. And then they ended up sort of like taking leadership essentially of Boeing. And now we're in this situation where, yeah, you're a company that more than the average company is really like entrusted with the well-being and the livelihood of your customers, and it is clearly not the priority. So anyway, yeah, appreciate that this is a story that we're talking about, and that you're sort of, I don't know, not directly digging into, but I'm curious to hear the conversation that's coming up after this and seeing how that sort of plays into it.
Yeah, and I mean, the last thing I'll say on this is just, you mentioned the fact that Boeing got worse in the merger. And I think that has to be a part of this conversation longer term. Like, if we as a society are going to be able to peel back the layers of corporate control that we live under, the first thing we have to do is start breaking up these companies. Like, it is, if you want to know why Canada spends the most money out of anyone on cell phones, it's because we only have two companies that control cell phones. If you want to know why we spend the most money on groceries, it's because basically Loblaws owns everything. You know, we've allowed these companies to become so big and so monopolistic or duopolistic, which is basically the same thing. Let's be real here. It has fundamentally changed the ability for anyone to sort of, like, the idea of capitalism has always been that, well, if you don't like it, start a new company and you can push the worst actors out. And the older you get, the more stale you get, you'll get worse, and then someone new will come up and will push you out. But that's so impossible now because of how big these companies are and how the number of ways that they have to sort of push you down, that more often than not, in almost all of these places, the goal of a new startup is to sell to one of the oligopolies. Like, the goal of almost any tech startup is to sell to either a Google or an Amazon or an Apple, and then that's success. And then you leave and you start a new thing, and your thing becomes a little new piece of whatever they're doing, and that's it. And no one is starting a new tech company that's going to actually challenge these companies. And that's true for so many different places. And that power that exists in consolidation has to be broken up, or we have no hope.
Yeah, and in a lot of cases, they're not even companies with names that we're aware of. Like the tech example you gave is a really good one. But like, for instance, it's like, I don't know, I think of like another this is rampant all across the economic system. But like another one, for instance, is like, I don't know, the skincare and pharmaceutical industry, which again is dominated by, like, guarantee you can have 75 different products in your bathroom. They are almost all going to be owned by L'Oreal or Procter and Gamble. Like, that's it. Those are your options. Maybe Johnson & Johnson, but like, it's shocking. And again, those are companies you might recognize. Half the time, they're not companies you're going to recognize. It's a hedge fund with like a weird acronym for a name, and they have no community accountability. They have no, they don't even really have much business accountability or accountability to a consumer, because there's so many steps removed that, I don't know, all they're going to do is if the customer doesn't like one of their specific brand names anymore, cool, they shutter it and funnel all of that same talent, all of those same products into another line. Anyway, it's a mess. It's a big old mess.
Yeah. And you know, the exact same thing exists, like, with the meta companies of the finance companies that then own all the other companies, right? Like, there becomes this 15, 20 companies that own each other, and then these megacorps that then own half of the brands we experience. And yeah, we're just not ever going to find a way to not have the wealth or value that exists in our ecosystems not extracted into the 12 people, unless we actually break up these companies and require some level of competition. Like, that's, and I'm not even someone who's going to go out here and say that I think competition is the answer to everything. I really actually would much rather a society that doesn't require that. But if you're going to force us to live in a capitalist system, at least make it capitalism. Like, at least make it a place where companies are competing with each other, rather than just trying to find the most useful ways to absorb money out of the working people and leave us as little as possible, which is where we're at right now.
Exactly that. It's why capital is capital and money, if you want to just like use more blatant terms, it's why money is concentrated and wealth is concentrated among not even the 1%. It's the 0.001%. Like you jokingly said, you're like 12 people. It's maybe not 12, it's maybe like, I don't know, 125. It's like literally no one.
So the Toronto police have assaulted more Palestine protesters, this time with horses. At least four protesters were sent to hospital this past weekend. Toronto Mayor Olivia Chow has approved a $20 million increase in police funding. She was originally against it, now she's supporting it. And dozens of Cop City police training facilities have been built across the United States since the George Floyd protests. And so, I mean, this is an answer to like, what are we doing? Why is nobody doing anything? Like, once people start doing stuff, they've got a plan for that, and that is a bunch of cops with horses and guns and very
100%.
specific training in urban warfare. So this is what we're looking at if we're attempting in any real way to dismantle the corporate systems.
Well, and then you start, as we talked about earlier on the show, the ways how many different places of these companies are funneling money into either it's cop benefits or it's hiring them as security for their own spaces, et cetera. I mean, what's interesting about this is that I was seeing a thing about how since the George Floyd protests, cops have killed more people year over year. Like, so if people thought that there was a huge reckoning and we were going to get real police oversight after 2020, all we have seen actually is the exact opposite. They have run rampant, and electing progressive councils and mayors has had a relatively weak effect on reducing cop budgets, or even reducing, like, increasing oversight. Like, you can see many major cities elected leaders who sort of pr who have put forward policies that have meant to rein in the police, only to have those either undermined by the council itself or to have pulled back on it. And what it tells me is that we need a much more coordinated and consistent effort on the grassroots level to be able to actually hold this to account. Like, we can't just rely on electing politicians because they will bow to pressure, and the cops have enormous amounts of political pressure. I mean, here in Ontario, most people agree that the on premier was taken down by the Toronto cops in the early 90s, because Bob Rae made them mad. Now there's other things that he did also. I'm not going to get into the whole Bob Rae thing because apparently people have opinions about that. But one of the things for certain is that the Toronto cops really wanted him gone, and he lost the next election. And so I do think that we have to find a way to build a much more sustained base of pressure if we're going to see these changes, because just electing someone off the top is not going to get us there. And it has been true here in Toronto, obviously, but it's also true, in American cities at large.
Yeah, and this is something that, like, I myself have been trying to dedicate a little more time to learning about, is sort of like the actual, like, the practices and the sort of like the ethos and the theories that underlie abolitionist movements, police and prison likewise, because there's a ton of really fantastic writing about it. And I think the anti-cop abolitionist movement is a little more robust in the United States, and I feel like those are actually kind of spaces that we can learn from a little bit, even if they I don't want to pass judgment, but like you said, police violence is as rampant as it's ever been. So like, success is a long and drawn out process, and it's not going to be a 1-2 punch that anybody wins anytime soon. But like you said, it isn't just as simple as electing somebody progressive, because I think from an outsider perspective, I don't live in your city in Toronto, but I mean, Olivia Chow was supposed to be and theoretically is a progressive mayor, and my assumption is she's been backed into a corner and pressured to increase police budgets. But the bottom line is that they've been increased, regardless of whether or not that is something that she theoretically went into office wanting to do. That's the outcome, and that's the bottom line here.
And what we saw with that specifically, which was interesting, was that they wanted to give them, I think it was $12 million less than they wanted in a $1.2 billion budget for the police, right? It's an
Unbelievable.
absolutely no amount of money in comparison to the overall budget. And that even that attempt brought out just this incredibly wide-ranging set of like every stop was thrown by the police association to get that $12 million that they wanted, and that was the difference between the two. And it just goes to show you that like even the threat of the idea of not getting exactly what they want is enough to sort of get their, you know, get their full version of their backs up. And then of course they get the $20 million, and then a week later, when asked how to stop, or when they were giving advice on how to stop home burglaries, their answer was put your car keys by the door so it's easier for them to steal your car, because that's what they actually want. And this was real advice the Toronto police gave people after saying that they needed $1.2 billion. Like, what are you doing $1.2 billion if your suggestion for avoiding people invading your home is to just give them your car? I mean, it's like, you got to presume there's other ways we can spend this money, but it's a whole other story.
All right, and we're going to go to a music break and come back with Stefan interviewing Chris Mohan and Gareth Gransall, convincing young business students not to invent pointless, money-sucking little applications and instead do something meaningful with their lives.
Out of time, out of tune, mouthing rhymes in his room, asleep or running through the street, his impulse deep as panic, to exult in sleepy raps amid the war. A simple force as electromagnetism, a gift horse with special pain within, running among the dryads, trying to wrap a spell for protection under one of my hats. This final act of depression, rivaling Sophocles in tragedy on these Vancouver streets, acknowledging the land we need. Clothed in vanity, Canada bleeds these robes of black freedom, standing beneath the sun. We'll let history judge our judgment as we get flippantly fucked as punishment, and the Tribune publishes our consent. We enter the room muttering its contempt. These actresses elegantly drawn and captured by the leprechaun. These orcs under hypnosis, forced to hunt this Moses. But of course, courting the poet is like a porno out of focus. These intimations.
Welcome back to the Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, or perhaps on one of our greatly appreciated radio syndicates across the country, or maybe you found us on the podcast, you found anywhere podcasts can be found, including now with the Harbinger Media Network. If you've not checked them out, do so. As previewed earlier on the show, my name is Stefan Hostetter, and I am here with Christopher Mohan and Gareth Gransall, who are the Director of Research and Campaigns and the Co-Executive Director. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Stefan. It's really exciting to be on this podcast with you. The organization that we represent is called Regeneration, Re-Generation, which is a youth-led nonprofit that exists really to empower the next generation of leaders in our society to rethink how the economy can better serve human and ecological well-being. And we originally started with a much more unwieldy name that nobody could ever remember, which was seven words long in 2019 as the Canadian Business Youth Council for Sustainable Development. And very quickly, we realized that this name was, you know, very cumbersome, but also not very inclusive in that it sort of limited our scope to just business students. Originally, the genesis of this name is that it emerged as a network of sustainability and social impact clubs at business schools across the country. And the idea was to create a pan-Canadian constellation of organizations that were rethinking the role of business in our society from the perspective of youth. But in 2022, we rebranded to Regeneration to become more inclusive of all youth, and also to invoke the idea that the future of sustainability is regenerative and embodies regenerative values, which means putting human and ecological well-being at the center of every decision, and also to express the idea that we believe that we are the generation of young people that will make that a reality. And so related to that goal, we have sort of three main pillars as an organization, which include Rework Your Future, which is about the career development work that we'll explain later in the episode, but also Reimagine Your School, which is about developing capacity building and providing resources for students to influence curriculum change within their schools. And then also Rethink Your Society, which is about empowering youth to have conversations about systems change while advocating for public policies that help advance a regenerative economy. And that's us.
Awesome. Thanks, Gareth. And so that answers the first question, which is the basics and what regeneration is and how you started. Can you tell me more about your manifesto, which is Our Future, Our Business?
Totally, yeah. So the manifesto that we wrote in 2020 was a statement that sort of was an exposition of our principles that we wanted to share to influence the national conversation around at the time, which was very much focused on Build Back Better and how do we respond to the emergency of COVID. And we wanted to really add the voice of youth to those conversations. In our view, you know, there's an increasing realization that the status quo of the economy and politics is broken. We're reaching climate tipping points. We're in the sixth mass extinction, but also democracy is threatened all around the world. There's, you know, you see the rise of authoritarian governments, the border industrial complex. And our belief is that really all of these problems are interrelated and have a root cause. And that is the cause that we wanted to explore in this manifesto, which is basically the problem that over the last 40 to 50 years, we have emphasized a model in which businesses and corporations maximizing short-term value for shareholders was seen as the only way to achieve social progress. And this is sort of has been described in various ways as a kind of top-down class revolution in reverse, as Warren Buffett once said, there's class warfare, but it's my class against yours, and we're winning. And so this way of thinking about the role of business in our society in a very extractive sense has really infiltrated the way that all political actors on all sides of the political spectrum see the role of markets in our society. And this was a very conscious political project undertaken by libertarian billionaires that pursued a campaign of influence through techniques to essentially influence the public and spread disinformation, but also to fund think tanks to influence the marketplace of ideas. And the reality is that those interventions have led to the sort of winner-take-all economy that we have now, which has all kinds of perverse consequences that go far beyond just climate destruction. But there's also mounting inequality, mass layoffs, financialization, and the inflation of asset prices as a substitute for real growth, the explosion of unfair trade rules, and the system of unequal globalization that creates an extractive economy that really benefits investors over governments, particularly in the global south. And in our view, this is a system that is kind of an illusion of growth to mask the theft of wealth from the public. And it's no wonder that the system is breaking down and populations are becoming increasingly radicalized. And so our view is that if we don't take a systems perspective on these intersecting problems and reconcile with the role of business in all of this, we are part of the problem. And so the manifesto that we wrote in this time period, to bring it back to your question, was basically a youth-led movement to challenge the status quo on a lot of these issues and really call for sweeping reform of how capitalism is taught and performed in our society. And the aim was to sort of talk about some of these more systemic challenges in a way that expanded the Overton window and increased the terms of the debate. And so we had 20 statements that we released, which were some of which covered more mainstream solutions, but then also ones which addressed, you know, neglected but crucial issues that we thought needed to be talked about more, including inequality, class power, neocolonialism and racism, extractivism, and even questioning the logic of infinite growth on a finite planet. As part of the manifesto, we had 65 youth organizations that were involved in its creation, and the initiative also got support from 100 civil society organizations and over 130 executive leaders that were supporting the movement to recognize the necessary transformation of business, education, and the business world in our society.
Awesome. And it's so interesting, I find, that this campaign comes from a business student angle, because, I mean, historically, the business sectors or the business studies parts of universities end up being the most likely to be pushing this idea of capital at all costs. And so it's interesting that you managed to sort of take that and are trying to, you know, attack the social license of these companies in another way. We'll get to that sort of piece in a second, but I am intrigued by, like, I presume you as founders were all business students when you started this. That's how sort of how you all came together. Am I correct on that?
Yes. Yeah.
And so I'm curious, how did you find each other? You know, how did that happen before we get on to your theory of change?
Yeah, that's a great question. Originally, the organization started when I was the founder of the Ivy Social Impact Club at the Ivy Business School, which is at Western University, in which capacity I met Maxime Lacat, who was the founder of the Des Hotels Sustainability Network at McGill University. And we sort of came together and wanted to build ties with organizations across the country. But also at Western, I was involved with a group called the Climate Crisis Coalition, which I also helped sort of get off the ground. And that has since really taken off in terms of being a site of campus advocacy at Western, which is also through, you know, through that work is how I met Chris. So I'll let Chris also introduce himself and talk about the genesis of our work.
Yeah. So I went to the same school that Gareth went to, and I eventually in my undergraduate time got really involved with the Climate Crisis Coalition. We're talking about the era, maybe like as school was coming back in person during the COVID-19 pandemic. And for those like listening who kind of followed the divestment movement, there was kind of like a lack of coordination happening in Canada, and there wasn't much happening particularly at Western either. So I was part of a cohort of students that kind of recharged the campaign, really went after the university for its greenwashing. Western University was one of those schools that opted, instead of responding to kind of community concerns from students, professors, and staff to divest, opted instead to produce very long-winded sustainable investing report. So that's where I got like a first taste of using my business knowledge to really dissect the claims being made by the sustainable investing report. And then kind of using an activist perspective to spin it back and say, well, hey, we did the due diligence on what you're claiming to accomplish, and it's unfortunately a lot of bullshit. So that's how I got involved with climate at Western, got a little bit involved with an amazing organization called Change Course, formerly Banking on a Better Future. And that's how I eventually got connected to Regeneration.
Awesome. And it's so good to hear that there's real change bubbling up within these institutions that I feel like have so long just funneled students into, you know, these very, very corporate mindset pieces, which we'll get into in a second with your Rework the Future campaign. But before we do that, quickly, what's your theory of change? How are you planning to work this? And you referenced your other pillars earlier, Gareth, so I'm wondering if you can expand on that slightly.
Yeah, absolutely. It is hard to put sort of into a into a box in a neat kind of way, in the sense that when you're pursuing systems change work, there's a lot of things that sort of get grouped into that. And we know we've been through many iterations of our organization over time. And so there's been lots of different theories of change over time. But I would say overall, most of the work that we do is sort of really focused on cultural transformation and changing norms and attitudes. And as I mentioned earlier, shifting the Overton window in terms of what it is that the next generation of leaders, both in corporations and in politics, come to believe and know about their societies. And so one of the key aspects of that is that in whatever capacity we can, we try to address the elephant in the room in a lot of conversations, which is corporate power and this problem of shareholder primacy. And in particular, we want to accompany the next generation of leaders through their journey of rethinking those root problems. So first, while they're at school with the curriculum advocacy and the mobilization that they do as organizers within their campus communities, but then also empowering people to both find employment that is in a sector that sort of helps create a better world, but also advocate within their roles as employees to help transform their organizations. And then finally, to eventually find leadership positions in society where they can actually affect systemic change across the world and within Canada. And so we want to, our aim is to create resources and capacity building toolkits at every step of the way. And in particular, all of that is oriented around this idea of changing the notion of what meaningful leadership actually means and what it means to build and lead an organization that actually creates value for society, which is not just about maximizing shareholder value. It's fundamentally about regenerating social and natural systems and creating an economy that exists safely within all of the planetary boundaries while also meeting the minimum social foundations that are needed for human beings to flourish. And a major part of that is also about recognizing when markets are or aren't a tool for achieving these goals, and recognizing that there are inherent limits to what businesses can do and that we necessarily need governments and public policies to advance the reforms that are necessary for the transition to a just and clean economy. And so in this aspect of culture change, you know, we particularly push against these very deep-rooted problems which require changing norms. So for example, within a lot of corporations and also in business schools, there's this misconception that corporate leaders have a legal duty to maximize short-term returns called shareholders, and this is called fiduciary duty. But actually, in Canadian law, that is not correct. The idea that fiduciary duty requires maximizing shareholder return is not true. And in reality, under Canadian law, corporate directors have what is called a duty of care to the interests of the corporation, which is a phrase that can be interpreted in many ways. And so a lot of our work actually hinges around changing these prevailing cultural norms to help expand people's imagination of what is possible. This also has a trickle-down effect into the education that young people learn in business schools, which is why we have a lot of focus on business education. And we recently wrote a report which summarizes a lot of our findings in this regard, which is that, you know, young people are taught and given frameworks, particularly in their finance and economic courses, which are very abstract, outdated models that are completely, that misrepresent real world behavior and are unequipped to deal with the long-term problems that we face. Another key challenge that we want to address is that in business schools, there is a dominant culture of prestige that sort of reinforces these problems, where too many smart young people go to business school just to go and work in professional services fields like management consulting or high finance like private equity or hedge funds, which are often in many cases very disconnected from the real economy, can have a major role in worsening inequality while also in many cases exacerbating the climate crisis. And one of the things we want to do is sort of talk about those challenges openly and provoke people to think more deeply about the meaning of their work, which is also what leads us very nicely into the campaign that we just launched.
Awesome. Wonderful segue. I appreciate it. And to your campaign you just launched, if we have time, I would love to come back to this idea of how we manage to pull ourselves away from this unbelievable obsession with maximizing shareholder value. Because I think, I mean, my feeling in the last 5-10 years has been that it has really fundamentally broken the difference between maximizing shareholder value and actual value to anyone using products in the last 10 years, I think, even pretending that those things are connected has broken down as you watch the collapse of the media industry or the collapse of even movie industry, the way that that's happening, or the entire internet somehow getting worse over the last 10 years with no seemingly value being shared with us at all. And so, yeah, anyways, I do think that...
Well, we're happy to comment on that.
Take it away. No, let's do that for a second. Yeah, comment on that. Absolutely. Because like it's right in everyone's faces right now, you know? Like, it's hard to avoid.
Absolutely. I'll talk quickly about this, and then I'll pass it over to Chris also, because I know he's reading a really great book on this subject. But the problem that you describe is one that's very endemic and has been sort of creeping along for 40 years, but the very visceral consequences of it are only really becoming very tangible recently, and it's having major political consequences. And this is the problem of, basically, in very simple terms, there's economists such as William Lozonik, and then also his longtime collaborator, who's a very influential economist named Mariana Mazzucato, have talked about the difference between the value creation regime and the value extraction regime. And the difference between these two things is very much related to the concept of an economic rent. And rent extraction is basically what happens when sort of a price is charged for no underlying value actually being transacted. When you have a productive economy where you're investing in increasing returns to scale, so let's say value-added manufacturing, you have an economy that's really based on increasing overall productive capacity in a way that creates jobs and creates wealth and builds the middle class. And the problem that we've faced over the last even 30, 40 years is that we've moved towards an economy that does less and less of that and does a lot more outsourcing and offshoring and automation and basically bundling and packaging of these securities that then essentially just create permanent income streams for people in the 1%, where, you know, people that are poor are becoming more and more indebted and having to pay more and more fees and contracts and all these kinds of things without any actual underlying value being achieved. This is also very related to the growth of monopolies, which is highly influenced by the growth of sectors like investment banking that make a lot of money off of mergers and acquisitions, where their actual business model is to increase the concentration of wealth in our society. But yeah, Chris, maybe you can also talk about rentier capitalism and that book that you were the other one, Our Assets in, what is it called? I forgot.
Yeah, Our Lives in Their Portfolios, both written by Brett Christopher's great book. And it really goes in, rentier capitalism goes in sector by sector and kind of describes the scale of the problem, extremely well researched. What I want to add, though, is while I was in school, I also studied software engineering. And so I'm particularly interested in well of the platform side of this kind of monopolistic capitalism. A great term, initiatification, has kind of entered the ether. You can also call it like chokehold capitalism. And essentially, like Gareth was describing, and we're really well acquainted with this in Canada because so many of our most important industries are just monopolized. The same thing is kind of happening, has already happened and solidified on the internet. And so essentially a lot of these, you know, like blue chip, like consistent profit generating organizations, they just have monopolies on certain platforms and they're going to continue to charge users a certain fee, or they just extract user data and they sell that for the cost of our privacy so we can continue to be sold more products that we absolutely do not need. But I think like, I don't want to end this in like, this part of the conversation with this is awful and it's everywhere. There are absolutely ways that we can start to tackle this. And it does require a higher level of public sector leadership in regulating these industries. In many ways, it might also require public sector or local level competition with some of these big players. And that's part of the kind of imagination we want to inject with the campaign we're talking about here, is that yes, there are all these awful problems, and oftentimes it's the corporate sector that's the perpetrator, but there are so many young, bright, smart people who want to see things done differently, and we want to lead that charge.
Awesome. Yeah. And a second great segue into the next question, so I'm not going to miss this one. part of the reason you're here is to and talk about the new campaign you're launching called, I believe it's called Rework the Future. Dude. Correct me if I'm wrong. Amazing. Nailed it. Your Future. Right. So Rework the Future is the platform. Your Future is the campaign. Amazing. So can you tell us about that and what you're trying to do?
Yeah. So the campaign is many things, but first and foremost, it's a youth-led campaign to accelerate the just transition to a clean economy in Canada. And we want to empower young people to feel that they can indeed work for a values-aligned career. And we want to show corporate Canada, specifically many of the traditional firms, that young people are prioritizing impact and their values in their careers more now than before. And we spoke earlier of like this crisis of imagination, you know, to borrow like words from someone, the old economy is dying and the new one refuses to be born. We cannot imagine what the future looks like if we're going to have a sustainable regenerative future. And we need young people to believe and start acting on a future that we need. So especially looking into these business schools where we have so many students entering to traditional corporate careers like consulting, high finance, we need to redefine what prestigious careers actually are. So it's not just getting a typical corporate job or being a part of like a prestigious firm. We need to change that narrative. We need to change the script. And we need to show these same employers who are lagging on many of the key indicators that we're demanding in our campaign that young people are prioritizing impact in their careers. And if they are going to see through your greenwashing, you're not going to be able to get talent. You're not going to be able to get smart people to work for you. And we're really hoping to scare these firms because they're recruiting the best and brightest, but the best and brightest kind of see through some of the nonsense that they're promoting. Their whole business model could be at stake. So what is actually the campaign? So in its current phase, it's an excellent website of extensive resources targeted towards young people who are looking to get informed, get involved, and get a job in the clean economy. So what exactly is the clean economy? It's an economic system that prioritizes sustainability, health, and well-being for both people and the planet, really aligned with our mission here at Regeneration. And it's not just about a fossil-free future. In a future regenerative economy, we're going to have to transform many different areas of the way we do things through seven key sectors that we've identified. So that includes sustainable food, green infrastructure, ecosystem restoration, clean energy, sustainable mobility, circular economy, and impact investing. So listeners, go to our website, re-generation.ca, because on that website, we have a landing page for each of those sectors where we have information for how you can get informed, get involved, and get a job. So that includes a brief of what are the issues and solutions happening in that sector, multimedia recommendations, including documentaries, articles, reports, podcasts for how you can become more informed, volunteer opportunities for how you can get informed with NGOs who are advocating in this sector, and a comprehensive job board. The most exciting part is that every month for the next 7 months, we'll also be releasing a small documentary series focused on each of the seven sectors. So just under 2 weeks ago, we released our first documentary called Roots of Change, Unveiling Sustainable Food Movement. And so in each of these documentaries, we'll be highlighting public, private, and non-for-profit organizations who are leading in this sector. And for example, in Roots of Change, we highlighted an amazing organization called Sundance Harvest that helps underprivileged communities gain access to experiences in agriculture. And we're really hoping to create excitement and kind of spread the knowledge about the great work happening in these areas.
To sort of add on to that in terms of other aspects of the campaign, because there is a lot to sort of cover here, the demands that we have for employers are one of the central pillars of the campaign, which essentially calls on companies and organizations to support the just transition to a clean economy, of which we have four key elements that we've identified, which include raise support for clean energy and phase out fossil fuels, reduce emissions in line with global climate goals, respect Indigenous rights and sovereignty, and restore nature and protect biodiversity. And you can read more about how we define those demands in very specific detail in the FAQ page on our website, and also the advocacy toolkit that we also have available below the demands on our website. But just to say a little bit more about that directly, so for raise support for clean energy and phase out fossil fuels, we are expecting organizations to align their capital allocation with the net zero scenario developed by the International Energy Agency and phase out fossil fuels in a timeline that is compatible with a 1.5 degree future as outlined in science. This applies also for the need to reduce emissions in a real way that doesn't over rely on, you know, cheap carbon offsets and actually invests in emissions reductions with clear interim targets and with clear planning as to what constitutes a meaningful and actionable climate transition plan. In terms of respecting Indigenous rights, we are very adamant that it is the role of organizations to specifically support the free, prior, and informed consent of Indigenous nations across so-called Canada, and specifically have free, prior, and informed consent policies for all project development, and specifically aligned with the 90-second call to action of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which specifically relates to the role of the corporate sector. And then with respect to restoring nature, we think it's very important for organizations to align with the global targets of the Kunming Global Biodiversity Framework, and specifically take actions to end deforestation by 2025. And we've outlined exactly how we envision these things, as I mentioned, on our website. But the most important piece of the campaign that I'll also talk about briefly is sort of the recruitment pledge that we are going to announce in the fall, which specifically targets certain organizations that we believe are violating our demands in the most egregious ways. And we have specific companies in mind that we do not want students to work for, and we will sort of be releasing a campaign to explain those various components of our campaign coming out in October. So please stay tuned for that, which will also coincide with a longer 45-minute documentary that we have coming out around the same time, which focuses on the political and influence of the fossil fuel sector, specifically in Canada, over the last 50 years in terms of the ways that they've been able to influence the public imagination on this issue and work to sort of capture governments and policymaking processes and prevent the transition in order to benefit their own profits. And so we have a lot of leaders and journalists, former politicians, and professors and other experts participating in this documentary. And we're very much looking forward to using it as a sort of consciousness-raising item of public education. You can also see similar work in the Debunk Fossil Fuel Myths section of our website, where we have a comprehensive list of PDF tools that help people sort of anticipate disinformation from the fossil fuel industry and use facts to debunk them and to fight against incorrect information.
Amazing. And so one last question before we tell folks how they can get involved. The big thing here is about removing social license, which maybe is not a term that the average person might be aware of. It's been spoken a little bit about with campaigns against oil companies and certainly some of the fight against RBC. But can you talk to us about what the current term social license means and why it's so important?
Yeah. So what is social license? So social license refers to whether it's an industry, an organization, or a specific project. It refers to its approval within local communities, the public, and the political class. So like you mentioned, social license is a key part of divestment movements on campuses or even infrastructure site fights because they want to erode the social license of fossil fuel companies. So these campaigns focused on elevating backlash from Indigenous communities, the public, so they can demonstrate why a certain activity shouldn't continue. And in theory, once something loses its social license, it ceases to operate. It can't continue. And that's why getting rid of the social license of the fossil fuel industry has been a key pillar of the climate movement. And as an aside, it's important to conceptualize that when we're talking about the fossil fuel industry's power, it's not just our dependence on their infrastructure and their energy systems. It's also the social and political power that they employ to influence conversation, public perception, politicians, critical legislation. So it's a huge issue. Our campaign expands the scope of culpability and threatens to erode the social license of corporations, specifically banks, consulting firms, and PR firms who are enabling fossil fuel expansion. So it's not just the big bad fossil fuel companies, it's the big bad fossil fuel companies and their corporate enablers. And we want to make that extension. So what's particularly egregious is that oftentimes these organizations are playing cover for the fossil fuel industry through financing, greenwashing, coordinated lobbying, and public messaging. So for our core audience, which is business students, our goal is to revoke the social license of these fossil fuel enabling companies so as to influence students' future career choices and their willingness to work for them. So this includes equipping them with technical understanding of concepts like carbon lock-in, stranded assets, and really challenging them to think about the enabling ecosystem pushing for the status quo and what the economic consequences of this are.
Awesome. And so if folks have now heard this and want to support your work, how can they do it?
Absolutely. So if listeners would love to get involved with our campaign, they can reach out to me, Chris, at chris@re-generation.ca. Maybe Stefan, you can provide it in the show notes. They can also follow us on Instagram or LinkedIn, where we have a lot of great engagement and content. We're currently running an ambassador program where we're connecting youth across the country who are passionate about the green economy, and we hope to open another cohort sometime this year. So stay tuned. If you're a young professional looking to navigate internal change at your organization, we have a confidential tip line through Signal and through email where you can connect with us and discuss how you can accelerate internal change. And if you're interested in getting involved on the ground and advocating for corporate climate accountability, absolutely connect with our friends at Change Course. There is a really important upcoming action. RBC is hosting their AGM in Toronto. So if folks are interested, another great opportunity to show support for this movement demanding corporate accountability on climate and reconciliation.
Wow, they moved it back to Toronto. They're not off in Saskatoon this year. That was when I...
So fun about that, it's in Etobicoke. And it's in the middle of three different highways and really inaccessible. So
at least we prevented them from having fun, which I think is at least the beginning of, you know, if you're putting your event in the middle of three highways, I mean, a little on the nose, to be honest, for folks leading to climate change. But anyways, thank you both so much. This has been Chris Mohan, the Director of Research and Campaigns with Regeneration, and Gareth Gransall, the Co-Executive Director also of Regeneration. Thank you both so much and have a wonderful day.
Thanks for having us. Thank you so much.
It's not easy.